So we'll do a Ruby demonstration. And then I want to divide things into three basic categories. The first group is basically the types of things that you might find in the language itself. And then the next group of things would be things that you might find in frameworks, such as Ruby on Rails. And then finally, we'll talk a little bit about the community overall. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Bruce Tate. I've been a Java proponent for a long, long time and really got dragged away from Java kicking and screaming. And this is basically what happened. I worked with a startup company to build an application with a lightweight Java stack, which is, well, Spring, Hibernate, the usual suspects. We used WebWork. We also had looked at Tapestry to do the same thing and done some prototyping. We finished something that had been done on the .NET stack in a year. We finished it with a team of half the people, but in 4 months. So we were pretty pleased. I had been talking to a guy named Dave Thomas, which is a big Ruby on Rails proponent, and he basically told me to stop calling him about Ruby on Rails until I had done something non-trivial, right? It's the only time I've ever heard Dave Thomas say shut up, but he said, shut up, Bruce, and call me when you've done something non-trivial. So I wanted to crush the framework with my application and just finished the whole data model in a remarkably short time. So it was 2 nights for the data model. I called my business partner to tell him, hey, we should really consider this thing. He finished everything that we had built the whole time in 4 nights. Now, I mean, I know all the counterarguments that, this is our second time through, that we already had a lot of the infrastructure and a lot of the thought work done. But, you know, that's kind of like somebody wandering around in Phoenix, and it's 120 degrees outside, saying, yeah, but it's a dry heat, you know? Hot is hot, and fast is fast. So I was really distraught because I thought, you know, if this really pops big, then the type of engagement that I really want to be doing, which is database-backed, web-enabled applications, is going to be so much faster on this that I'll get undercut. So I was already getting my consulting business undercut by the offshoring, and so I really couldn't take that chance. So I started doing some research. And you'll see in this session and the other session, a lot of the things I've come up with. So basically, I've got a company with a new name called Rapid Red. My goal is to do Ruby development for a year and then come back and do Java Ruby integration once the integration strategies are a little bit more mature. So that's where I'm coming from. I'd like to start with a little short section called What I Believe. Basically, because of all the hype on the server side, I want you to understand exactly where I'm coming from. I believe that Java has been the most successful language of all time. Still believe that. I believe that Java is the most successful language of all time. Part of the reason that I got there is due to effective stewardship. The language has been managed beautifully by Sun and the Java community. I think it's really an amazing story when you think of how far we've come in 10 years. But, you know, when you're successful, you're going to bloat. If you look around at programming languages out there, I bet that Squeak does not bloat. I bet that Haskell does not bloat. Or Lindon. Or Lisp. But Java bloats, and the reason is that we've been so successful for so long. You have more customers to satisfy. You have more political interests to satisfy. That's going to lead to additional things in the library and competing interests that tug and pull in Java in unnatural ways. Right? And no language is going to last forever. But I think that with a more aggressive approach to the Java language, that we can be better off and extend the life of language. Okay? So, one of the things that I learned as I researched Beyond Java and later the book called From Java to Ruby, which is a book targeted for managers, is that lines of code matter. And we Java developers like to tell ourselves that we're insulated because we have code generation, because we have IDEs, we basically have many strategies to manage the number of lines of code that we have. But they matter. In reality, a Java developer has to work harder than developers in more dynamic languages. Right? Now, we've been able to overcome this because our language has been so clean that we could say, okay, you're going to be more productive over the short haul. But in the long haul, as I maintain the application, as I extend the application, this language helps me make the right decisions so I'm in better shape. But what's happening now is we're starting to go beyond the quick and dirty. Right? Now, I know a lot of you saw the word Ruby in the talk, and you were ready to, at the Q&A, to walk up for your question and just say the word Perl, and then run back to your seat and sit down, right? But it's not like that. It's not like that. In this case, we've got something that is quick and clean, but only for niche markets. So I want to see how we can grab some of the approaches that are showing up in other dynamic languages so that we won't have to work as hard as we do right now. So when you look at lines of code, you have to look beyond just the first time pass through the code creation, right? Like getters and setters. We create an instance variable, getter, setter. Instance variable, getter, setter. Well, now, we don't type that stuff anymore. Our IDEs do it for us. But you still have to learn the IDE, and you still have to read the code. There's still the potential for adding bugs in that particular lines of code. So, pardon my language, but when I interviewed James Duncan Davidson, who was the creator of Tomcat and Ant, and responsible for pushing those into the open source community, he said that the number one problem with Java right now is that reliance on tools is bullshit. Right? I think that that's actually a great way of looking at things, in that if we start from a cleaner, simpler foundation, then it's much easier then to tool on top of that, and then you're getting additional leverage by building on top of a cleaner foundation. And that's the approach that some of the other languages have taken. One more myth that I want to basically explode before we really get going. Many people believe that languages like Ruby and Perl will never have the IDE support that Java has. How many people believe that? It's okay. You can raise your hand. So there's a few of you out there. There's probably a lot of people that haven't raised their hands yet. If you look at probably the most productive IDE of all time, it's got to be the Smalltalk refactoring browser, right? And that doesn't have a static typing model. Okay, so some things that I'm not going to say that might surprise you. I'm not going to say that Java needs to be dynamically typed, because the second that you say that Java is dynamically typed, it's not Java anymore. That changes the rules of the game too radically. I'm not going to say we need to ditch Hibernate and pick up Active Record, right? At heart, I am still and will always be an object relational mapping evangelist. I think that that's the right way to build a whole lot of software out there. I do think that we'd be better off if we looked for wrapping solutions when they make sense, things like IBATIS. And I'm not going to say that we should rebuild Ruby on Rails and Java. In fact, I think that that would be a fundamental mistake. One of the reasons that Ruby on Rails is so powerful is that it leverages the strength of the Ruby language. We need to do things like Garrett does within the right framework to leverage the unique strengths of the Java programming language to give us additional capability. Okay, so let's shift gears a little bit. I'd like to do a Ruby demonstration. How many of you have actually coded Ruby before? So, looks like, well, let me ask the inverse question. How many of you have not coded Ruby before? Okay, so most of you. That's a more accurate gauge, right? Sometimes, nobody will ever raise a hand to any question. Okay. So, Can everybody read that okay in the back? A little bigger? That's the best I can do. Okay. I'm going to open a Ruby interpreter. And I'm going to code the simplest Ruby application I know about. And that's this. That's going to return 4. Okay? 4 is an object. Well, what class is it? I can ask it. What methods does it support? Now, does that look strange to anyone? 4.methods. What would you do in Java? You query the class, right? So, 4 is also actually a class. Kind of strange, right? And there are the methods. I can sort that list. I can use something called... I need to go a little bit smaller. I can sort this list and use and print them out using something called a closure. We'll talk about closures later. So I'm going to get a method into this thing, and I'm going to say print the method, right? What did I do? 4.methods.sort, get a method, dot each. Get a method, print the method, right? And there they all are. So it's pretty cool. So one of the things that you should notice is that this is very much an exploratory language. You get an idea, you type the idea in the interpreter, you get a result out. And the roots of Ruby are very much the same as a scripting language. For example, I could do a directory. List, right? I could assign the results of that thing to a variable. One of the things that you notice about Ruby is that the typing model is very dynamic. How many people believe that Ruby is weakly typed? Strongly typed? Most of you don't. No opinion, or I'm afraid to say. Ruby is strongly typed, right? So if I do something like 4 plus string, it's going to complain. Why is it complain? Well, because they don't respond to the same messages. Right? And so I can't coerce one into the other. Okay, so we're strongly typed, but we're dynamically typed. And that's going to allow me to do things like, say, for example, just to give you an example of some of the things that I could do with 4, I could say 4.inspect. That basically means give me a string describing the contents of 4. You see the result here, the 4 at the bottom? Let's do something like this. Method is equal to inspect. All right? Then I can say 4.send method. Okay? So basically what's happening here is that Ruby is responding to a message called method. Now, one of the cool things, let me open up a document. These are the things that I wanted to cover. I'm just opening an editor called TextMate. Typing model, we talked about that. Classes, methods. Yeah, okay. So one of the things that you'll notice about Ruby is that it's very dynamic and very open. In fact, I can redefine anything. If you think about the scariest method in Java to redefine, what would it be? It's got to be on class, right? Maybe new? New would be the one that I would think of. Watch this. Now some of you Java developers are going to be violently ill over this. Okay? So I'm just going to go up, open up a text editor called Open Class. And what I'm going to do is So I'm in the interpreter, so I have to surround that with back quotes, and that's going to give me... Okay. So let me crank up the size here. Okay. Actually, let me just write this from... scratch, just so you can see what's going on. So there's already got to be a class called class, right? So what am I doing? I'm opening it up and I'm redefining it, right? Alias method I can already hear some retching in the back of the room. Bruce, why would you ever want to redefine the new method? Okay, well, here's a scenario for you. My good friend Dave Thomas is about to give a Ruby session, and he leaves his laptop unattended, right? So all I do is I say, define new. Got you now, Dave, right? And then I'm going to say, print the string, error, your laptop was unattended. Okay? Now, this is kind of like loading Albert Einstein's cigar. You really wouldn't want to do this, right? Okay, but so I'm going to define a method now. Oh, no. I need to call new, right? So I'm going to call new. So I'm going to say, but how do I call new? I changed the name, right, with that alias method. So I say old new. And then I pass it the same arguments. And just to make sure that we're working, I'm going to say string.new, and then let's run this thing. Oh, I got an error. Can't be right. Error, your laptop was unattended, right? So what did I just do conceptually? I just built an interceptor, right? So one of the things that you don't see in the Ruby language is an AOP framework, because it's easy enough to open up the class, drop in an interceptor with 4 or 5 lines of code, right? One of the things that you don't see with Ruby is a dependency injection framework. One of the reasons that we use dependency injection that we value it so strongly is because of its impact on our tests, right? Now, we're willing to take a little bit of hit for complexity and a little bit of extra weight in our code base because it gives us so much tremendous power in redefining the implementation of a class, right? You snap out the real-world implementation, and you snap in a mock. Well, a couple of days ago, I was writing some code to test a framework that was date-dependent. I opened up the date class, said return Groundhog Day, and then I closed the date object. And now every time that I call system get date, I get Groundhog Day over and over, right? Somebody has seen that movie. Okay, so basically, Ruby is a highly dynamic language. Now, does this bother anyone that I could open up and redefine new? It's okay, you can say it. It bothered me too the first time I saw it. Right? Now, this is a fundamental difference in philosophy between the Ruby community and the Java community. The Ruby community is not afraid to let you run with scissors. Right? Now, the Java community says, hey, you can run with those scissors, but give them to me first. And then you dull the tip, and then you dull the blade. Right? You see the difference? Now, so the question is, isn't that more dangerous? Well, I don't know. Sometimes it seems to be. I've burned myself with a bug like this one. I've burned myself in a demo with a bug. I've redefined new, and then I couldn't create anything, right, without it showing laptop unattended. But, you know, if you're a cook in the kitchen, do you think a dull knife is more dangerous or a sharp knife is more dangerous? Well, the dull one, because you're going to have to drive it harder and you're going to have to use it. You're going to have to work around the intended purpose of the knife. Okay, well, that's enough, Ruby, to get us started. We'll come back to it. Let's start to look at some of the things that we can do with Ruby. So the first idea is closures. Now, I know that many of you were going to say, well, you know, I just don't need closures. I've seen iteration with closures and that each is pretty cool, but what does it save you? 8, 9 lines of code? Well, think about this. How many of you still write basic JDBC? I mean, I write some. Probably 7 or 8 of you. I was in Phoenix and asking people how they actually wrote a JDBC method. And everybody said, well, okay, well, you open the connection, you specify your query, execute the connection, then you iterate through the result set, and you start working through all this stuff. And then I said, well, what do you do when you're done? And they said, well, you close the connection. And I said, well, where do you close it? And everybody goes, finally block. Yeah, finally. And then I said, what happens if you don't close the connection in a finally block? And the guy in the back of the room started to get really red. And nobody answered the question. And they were looking at this guy really nervously. Well, I did something really stupid. I asked again, what happens if you don't close the connection in a finally block? And the guy in the back of the room stands up and he says, you get fired! That's what happens! And I thought, well, yeah, we've invested a lot of emotion in the fact that somebody didn't close the connection in the finally block. And then we were up at 11 o'clock at night just banging against a bug, right? What we really wanted to do is let the system handle all of that boilerplate work around the JDBC, and we wanted to do the work on the inside, which is precisely what the Spring framework does and a lot of the newer JDBC frameworks. And they simulate that closure with an anonymous inner class, right? But the anonymous inner class is ugly. It's really ugly, and it takes a lot of work. So a lot of us, as a result, don't do it anymore. Do you guys follow the Dilbert cartoon here? Right? Well, it's kind of... So Dilbert is a guy at a typical big company with managers that stink, right? And so in this Dilbert episode, a new guy walks into the room and says, hey, I've got a new idea. And 6 managers come around, they hose him down with ice cold water. Right? The next day, the same guy comes in and he says, hey, I've got another idea. Same 6 managers, ice cold water. And Wally leans over and he says, hey, don't worry, eventually the urge just goes away. And that's what happened to us. We had to code this anonymous inner class often enough where the design pattern just went away. But these closures are very, very useful things. Look at this. So if you want to be more concise, this is the one that you might say, well, okay, you didn't really save me that much code. 100.times right on the chalkboard, Java's not dead, right? That's what server-side wanted to make me do, right? But that's not the only thing. There's a way to take all of the boilerplate out of very common operations, like a JDBC connection, like a file, right? Think of all the try-catch, think of all the boilerplate code that you have to write to do a basic file operation in Java. With Ruby, file.open, f.do something, right? This is the closure. This is a block of code that gets passed in there. It's going to give me a file, and then I can do something with the file. That's cool. What does that save? That saves the setting up the file, managing the resources, and tearing down the file and managing the exceptions if things break. That's cool. You can also improve common idioms. This is one from Smalltalk, written in Ruby. If I have a translation, why not just take the translation and say isolate? That means do everything that follows in the scope of the translation. That's beautiful to read. That do end block is tells me exactly where the edges around my transaction are. And again, in Java, and with the Spring framework, you can do this, but you do it with anonymous inner classes. Here's a really cool one that made my jaw just drop open when I saw it in Ruby on Rails. At the top, you see a typical controller method. It's kind of lightweight, so it's going to throw some of you. But basically, it says define a list and then set up the instance variables that the views are going to consume. And then it's going to invoke a default view called list. in the directory for whatever controller this is on. Does that make sense? That's pretty cool. We'll see how that works later on. What if I want to enable this to be a web service? Or I want to share an HTML for use with JavaScript? Here's what I do. I say, define a list. Set up the people, just like before. And then I say, response to. This is a method that was written to take a closure. And that closure is going to handle something, have a responder, and I'm going to call it wants. Now I can say, wants.xml, if you want XML, do this. If you want HTML, you don't have to do anything. If you want JavaScript, you don't have to do anything. That is now enabled for Ajax, web services, and pure HTML. That's cool. Right? Why? Because we're customizing, really, from the outside in instead of the inside. We're customizing from the inside out instead of the outside in. It opens up a whole new direction of thinking for the Java programmer. Now, the next idea is continuations. Well, what's continuation? Until the last couple of years, we would think that they were abstract concepts that our programming languages teachers just wanted to torture us with, right? Because all of the examples were all academic and all useless, right? You would write this 8-line block of code that would do nothing but break, right? Thanks, no thanks, I'll code a break. Or you do things like cooperative multiprocessing. Only our processors now have the multiprocessing and threading support built in. So what is a continuation? If you're a video game programmer, got to ask you a question. What if you're about to walk into the monster control center and you have 4 hit points left? What do you do? Save game, right? A continuation is the save game, right? You save the game, you walk into the control center, you get killed. You walk in again, you get killed. You restore, you walk in again, and you succeed. And you save game, and then you drink all the potions, right? Well, the continuation is all about capturing the state of execution, just like the state of the game, at one point in time. Right? That sounds, well, cool in a way, I guess, but completely academic. Until you think, wait a minute. As a web developer, I'm doing nothing but managing state for a huge chunk of the time. Now, we implement the web with a stateless model. Why? Because it's easier for programmers? No, because it's scalable, right? Now we don't have to bind each individual session to all the resources for the session, right? I don't have to bind Bruce Tate to whatever database server until the time that I finish my wizard. And maybe I might go out to lunch or something, right? So I basically say, okay, well, we'll implement a stateless model, right? Problem solved. Well, for the application server, that's true. For the programmer, life kind of stinks. Because we have to say, okay, restore the state, work a little bit, save the state. And then the user does something. And then calls me back. And I restore the state, say, okay, where was I? And then I work a little bit, and I save the state. Well, what if instead of restoring the state, you took a continuation that had been captured from the session that was automatically put there by the framework and just picked up right where you left off, right? So that's what Garrett's application, what the Rye framework does. And what that means to you is that you get stateless type style performance, but you get a stateful programming model. So you don't see 1,900 different servlets in a Rife application. Now, we need to cook continuations into the basic programming language. They're not there yet. There are ways to work around the problem and simulate continuations. There are ways to actually provide limited implementations of continuations. It needs to happen. If you're interested in seeing what the support would look like, check out this link. If you're interested in seeing continuations in action, pick out the Rye framework. And the Rye continuations are actually being picked up by WebWork. And WebWork is going to be the action model for what? For struts. Right? So we're starting to see this idea pick off. If you want to see a demo of the framework that basically started all of this, check out Three Technologies to Watch. That's tomorrow sometime. Okay, the third idea is metaprogramming. And this idea is basically what convinced me that I needed to be doing Ruby. If you think of the hot Java frameworks right now, they all do this. They write programs that write programs. Right? So I take a POJO, and I want that POJO to be persistent. Hibernate. I take a POJO, and I want to layer on cross-cutting concerns. AOP. I take a POJO, and I want to do dependency injection, and then I want to implement cross-cutting concerns. Spring. Right? The hot frameworks in Java are all hooked into metaprogramming. So right now, the way that you implement metaprogramming in Java is you say, Garrett, Gavin, Rod, go write me a framework. Right? It's hard. We're talking about bytecode enhancement, about AOP, which makes it a little bit easier, but then it complicates your tool set. And then there are other metaprogramming techniques that are coming up. None of them do everything that we need them to. So what happens is we have this Frankenstein effect of bolt-ons, right? The AOP bolt-on, the XML bolt-on, the lightweight dependency injection container bolt-on. These things are all living with us right now. And the stack is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Sure, it's getting more powerful. And I don't want to in any way disparage the work that Rod and Gavin and the people who are innovative enough to do the bolting on are doing. That's absolutely the right thing to do for Java, right? Because it allows us to do things like delay binding, like weaken the coupling. But for Java, we have to work very, very hard to make this kind of stuff happen. So what would be interesting is to start cooking more of the metaprogramming techniques into the language in a friendlier way, right? So what's going to happen to our integrated development environments if we cook AOP in? Well, we'll get better support. We'll have fewer bugs. That's really not enough, though. We really need a concept called the mix-in that will allow me to bolt on a capability, a cross-cutting concern, just like you were implementing a subclass, but it doesn't have a multiple inheritance model. Right? This is the Smalltalk mix-in. A lot of languages have used it. For Java, think of an interface plus the implementation. Right? Wouldn't that be nice to be able to say, okay, this is a person object, but it's also secure, transactional, persistent. Right? Now I need dependency injection containers to do that. Probably still would, but it would be nice to have a mix-in model to manage that. Okay, so let's shift gears a little bit and move over to the framework level. I think that one of the things that steered us wrong was the idea that you have to do all of your configuration in Java in XML. Right? How many of you like working with a lot of XML? Okay, well, there's a couple of hands. There are always three or four. But the rest of them say, well, you know, I look at that, kind of picking my head out of the sand and looking at the landscape around, outside of the Java community. I didn't take enough time to do that, and I'm hoping that I can save you the same mistake by just showing you a hint of what's out there in other languages. I also hope that by exposing you to other languages and other ideas in those languages, I can help change the way that you're writing Java right now. Did somebody have a comment? Okay. So I'd like to start out each session with either a goal or a belief statement. And so I want to point out the three major things that I believe in this space. The first one is that for the first time in a long time, we're starting to see significant innovations happen outside of the Java community. And let me kind of temper that a little bit. Innovations that are actually garnering mass appeal. Does that make sense? So that we have Ruby on Rails, which is changing the way that we're writing Java frameworks. We have Seaside and Squeak, and that's changing the way that we implement Web MVC. And there are a couple of other things that we're paying attention to as well, like functional languages. So knowing about these ideas will absolutely change the way that you write Java code, particularly if you start to dabble in languages that take you to a higher level of abstraction. Now, if you move from Java to C Sharp, you might not see, it might not shape the way that you think. You're looking for languages that bring your way of thinking up. And I'd like to point out one final thing, that new language adoption is on a definite cycle. You can go all the way back to 54 with COBOL, 61 with Fortran, early 70s C, mid 80s C++, 96 Java, and now we're around 2006. So it's not quite like clockwork, but it's pretty close. You start to see languages move forward. Now, before I change this slide, this said no language lasts forever. But, you know, you could just come up and say COBOL, right? That hasn't lasted forever, just for the history of programming languages, right? But you can say that no language dominates forever. And I think that's definitely going to be true here. So without further ado, let's push on. And I want to explore three major areas that have had an impact on the way that I write code in any language. And those ideas are, first, metaprogramming. And I want to take you beyond Java a little bit so you can see how metaprogramming works in other more dynamic languages. And then I want to shift gears and get a little bit more radical with each step. I'm going to show you the coolest web development framework that you're never going to use. I say that you're never going to use it because it's written in Smalltalk. And we basically don't really have the freedom to implement Smalltalk in commercial situations that often. So we're going to look at a Smalltalk derivative called Squeak that was invented at Disney. And we're going to look at a concept called the continuation server. And it radically changes the way that you code stateless web applications. And then I'm going to shift gears one final time, and we'll look at functional languages, particularly in the area of concurrency. I think that we're about to see an interesting scenario play out where we have an exploding need because of the increased concurrency in the processors. And we also have some technology that closely matches the theory that you would have collected had you, for example, if you've gone to grad school in the area of distributed processing. That stuff's really not written in Java. It's written in more functional languages. And if we can bridge the gap between the theory and the implementation, sometimes surprising things can happen. So we'll look at Erlang. And I'm not going to suggest that you're going to be able to use Erlang in a production setting, or even Smalltalk, or even Ruby on Rails for that matter. But I am suggesting that these ideas are going to have an impact in some way on the way that you code 2 years from now, 3 years from now, even 1 year from now. Okay, so the first thing that I'd like to explore is the idea of metaprogramming. And you've seen many incarnations of metaprogramming throughout the week. How many of you saw Garrett's talk on the Rife framework? What'd you guys think? Pretty impressive stuff, right? I told him he needs to start with a demo, right? Because there's a lot of framework that you have to get through. And then you see this thing called Rife CRUD, where he codes a few meta lines that describes a model. And then he starts to say, well, what can we infer, right? And by inference, he layers on enough code to build you a default application that does create, read, update, and delete. And it's pretty impressive and pretty flexible. Now, I want to show you not how metaprogramming happens in Java, but how metaprogramming happens in other dynamic languages. So You're going to notice in Ruby on Rails that we have a couple of tools in the toolbox that I don't necessarily have on the Java space. One of them is I can open up a class at any time. If any of you were at the session yesterday, we literally redefined the new method on class. I'm not saying that that's a great idea for your journeyman developer, but being able to tack on an interceptor anytime, anywhere is a powerful technique. And Ruby's going to give that to you. There's another technique that I want to explore called method missing. And this is basically a method that gets called when an object doesn't respond to a given method. Now, you might think, gee, Bruce, I don't think I'd want to touch that. I mean, I'd rather leave that alone, because if you have a bug and method missing, then where do you go from there, right? But the philosophy of the Ruby community is dramatically different from the philosophy in the Java community. So the Ruby community is all about giving you sharper tools, right? Can you cut your heart out with those tools? Well, yeah, you can. You can shoot your foot off with that gun, right? But you can also do more powerful things more quickly. And the Ruby community's feeling is that the skill of the craftsman is important here. And we want to enable excellent craftsmen that do, you know, the lion's share of the work in any given project. So what we're going to get out of method missing is the ability to tack on dynamic behavior in the form of a language. Let me show you what I mean. In this case, we want to take a class called Roman, and we want to build a Roman numeral. Is that hard to read in the back? Should I bring it up in an editor? Let's do that. Okay, so I'll bring up TextMate here. And let's bring up a class called Roman, and I'll expand this. Is that font better? Bigger? Is that okay, or should I make it bigger? In the back, or raise your hand if you can see it. Okay. So basically what we're doing here is we're taking a class, and we want it to respond to Roman numerals. Say I'm building a domain-specific language. Oh, like, I don't know, something for a word processor to do outlining. And I want to be able to express Roman numerals in the base Ruby programming language. Now, what would that look like in Java? Well, I'd probably code up a Roman class, and then I'd probably have some type of conversion, right? So I would call Roman.convert, open parentheses, quotes, and then I'd code the Roman numeral string, right? Now, with Ruby, I can do the same thing, but I can do a little bit better. By overriding method missing, I can say, okay, if I get something that looks like a Roman numeral, I can go ahead and convert that, right? Okay, so in this case, I'm defining a class called Roman, and the only thing I'm going to do is override method missing. And this is going to give me the method implementations. Now, can you do that with fixed methods? Sure, but you're going to have a method for every Roman numeral, right? So in this case, I say take the name of the method. Then, if I match a regular expression that has I's, V's, X's, L's, and C's, in this example, I'll only count up to C, which is 100, then do this. So basically, my strategy is going to be to count the I's, V's, X's, L's, and C's, and assign the values to each. So the first thing that I have to do is handle the special case in Roman numerals, which says that if I have an X and I precede it by an I, that's a 9. So I do just a series of replacements here. So I'm going to replace the IV, which is 4, with 4 I's, IX with VII, which is 9, and the same thing for the other ones. Then I say return the count of I plus the count of everything else plus its value. Right? And what does this give me? Well, let's go ahead and convert some Roman numerals. So I'm going to say put S, which is print something out. I say Roman dot X, right? A few other ones. XC, XII. Yeah, I guess that's good enough. And then we're going to execute this. And here, you see, I don't know if I can blow this up or not. Yeah. Okay. There you see, here you see the results of the Roman numerals. So, but the nice thing is that I have changed the way that I express a thought to something that's much more clear. And that's one of the core concepts that you can use when you're building a domain-specific language. Okay? Now, is this technique a little bit controversial? Well, yeah, because you're redefining some of the debugging behavior that you get out of a missing method. So you can really get out of control with this technique. But that's the difference in philosophy between the Ruby community and the Java community, which wants to give you safety, right? Type safety, checked exceptions, and there are two different philosophies for building the language. But method missing completely revolutionizes the way that you look at certain problems in the Ruby space. Like, for example, where might you use method missing in a persistence framework? So I've got an existing implementation, which is literally, 15 lines of code or so, that does, let's cut over here, that it's basically a Rails implementation that keeps a database, that maintains a database of mountain bike trails, right? So I'm going to, let's create a new window. So I'm going to go to my existing application. Call trails for mountain bike trails. Let's go ahead and edit the source for this thing. And again, I'll have to expand the font. When you see the model, you're used to this because you saw it yesterday. You're going to notice that there's not much going on here. Right? There's actually more than meets the eye. What actually happens here is we use convention over configuration. We say, okay, well, I know that you're called trail. By default, I could map this to a table if I wanted to. But by default, I'm going to go to the plural of trail and look for a database called trails. I'm going to go to your database's system tables. Then I'm going to look and find which columns are defined. For each column, I'm going to dynamically add an attribute. Right? But that's not what I want to show you here. I want to show you the impact of method missing on this application. So I'm going to go to a console. And by the way, this is an example of when I said earlier on the expert panel, the debugging strategies of Ruby on Rails are basically just a little bit different. You've got powerful debugging. It just doesn't come in the form of an IDE debugger. Like, for example, I can manipulate my persistent objects in the context of a console. Okay, so I'm going to start the console. And let me cut over quickly and show you the definition of the table in question. So I'm going to open up a migration. Here's the table. So basically, I'm creating a table, and what you need to know is that by default, I'm going to get an identifier called ID, and then I've defined attributes for name, difficulty, and description. Okay, so I'm going to cut back over to the console. And can you guys read this okay? So I'm going to say trail is equal to trail.new. I'm going to say trail dot name is equal, what's a Spanish trail? Well, I guess we'll call it El Toro.
And then we'll say trail.difficulty. Well, if it's El Toro, it's got to be hard, right? Okay. One of the things that I want you to notice here is that I get a dynamic finder. So let's say trail.save. And I'm going to say give me some other trail equals trail.find. Now I can pass this an ID, right? I can also say find by name. Get that? Now I'm going to pass that El Toro. You say, well, name could be a convention, right? It's not a convention. What we're actually doing is overriding method missing. So I can, for example, say find by difficulty. Now that's interesting, but that's not overwhelming. But this is cool. Find by name and difficulty. Right? And I'm going to pass that El Toro and hard. Now that's cool. Right? So what I've done is used metaprogramming to define the semantics, to extend my language in a way that makes in a way that reads like English and makes a beautiful domain-specific language for accessing object relational mapping. Okay? So you're also going to see a second trick in Ruby in that you can open up a class and modify it at any time. Another thing that you can do is specify a method when you define a class. And this, notice, doesn't have a DEF or define in front of it. This is a method invocation. So a design pattern that you'll frequently see with Ruby is that I'll have a method with these parameters, which are name, email, and address. Well, that's going to create my attributes, which is an instance variable, a getter, and a setter. Right? So cooked into Ruby itself is the idea, the concept of metaprogramming, and I'm building now with higher abstractions. One line of code does the work of many lines of Java. Now, we have our IDEs to insulate us from this, but how many other places could we implement design patterns like this one that just raise the level of abstraction? So what happens here? This method gets fired. This method is actually on a module. The module called module, which you can think of as a Smalltalk mixin. If you haven't seen mixin, think of it as an interface plus an implementation. Okay, and this is the module that class is based on. So I'm going to open up the class, create an instance variable, and a getter and a setter for name, email, and address. Right? Here's another example. Let's go back to the Roman numeral example. And I also have an example called toRoman. Well, what would toRoman look like from a Java perspective? Well, again, we'd probably have some type of class, and we would pass the Roman class, we would fire a conversion method and then pass in, you know, some type of Roman numeral, right? But wouldn't it be cool to take just the number and say, give me a Roman numeral out of this? 6.2Roman, right? Well, by opening a class, I can do that easily. And then I can bring, for the purposes of a domain-specific language, I can use the vocabulary that's appropriate to my user base. In this case, all we're going to do is open up the fixed number, and then we're going to define a method called toRoman, and I'm going to take the value of self. I'm a fixed number, right? And then I'm going to I'm going to add a C while the value is 100, add an XC while the value is greater than 90, so on and so forth. Right? And then I get a syntax that looks like this. So for example, I could say 990.2, oh, that's too big. 290.2 Roman. Right? Or 74.2 Roman. Now, isn't that a nicer syntax than what I'd be limited to in some other languages? Oh, I need to print the value, right? And here I have the Roman numeral conversions. Pretty interesting. So you see this in blogs often, and it comes in the form of 4.days.fromnow. And so we can change, we can, based on the units that are required for my particular domain-specific language, I can build in conversions or simple operations, like I can redefine math. For example, time has a different base than our decimal system. Okay? So you can see that this is actually a very powerful concept for something like active record. Because now I can say, well, what types of behavior do I need to add to a class to manage a relationship? Then I can say, okay, I'm going to fire a method called belongsTo that opens up the class and adds everything that I need to manage a relationship. Like the application that you just saw for mountain bike trails, I can say, okay, give me the model object. Take that model object and say, this thing belongs to a location. And you'll notice in the migration, I have a I need a location ID. I don't have one here. So, we're a little short on time, so I'm not going to show you this part of the demo. What the heck, let's go for it. So I'm going to add a column called location ID. That's my foreign key. And I'm going to call that an integer. Now, normally I'd go ahead and write a new migration for this, but just to save time, I'm just going to back up and I'm going to migrate down. To zero, then I'm going to migrate back up to the current latest one. Okay, so it's given me a table called trails. And I want to say, give me a model called location. Okay, so I've got that migration. I'm going to come over here to the editor. And with location, I'm going to say this belongs or has many trails. Right? Now notice that though my model is a singular, I specify a plural here. So I'm really paying close attention to what makes this thing easy to maintain, and it's going to read like English. Okay. So now I need to go specify my migration, and you'll notice there's a second migration here that was generated for me. And a location should have, let's just say, it's going to have the name of a country and an identifier. And that'll be enough. And so I, again, go and run my migration. Okay. Oh, yeah. To call him to this country. Okay. Okay, I've already created that table, so things should run for me. I guess I created it in an earlier demonstration. So now I can open up my console. Oh. And you'll notice that I have an instance variable. I probably didn't save my. Okay, let's go back to my trail, my model, and this belongs to. Okay, you notice that this hasn't been saved yet. That's why my console didn't pick it up. So I'm going to say, give me a new trail. Notice that this now should have a location. I'm going to go ahead and skip this demo. I threw myself off early. But so the idea is that with syntax like this, I can open up a class definition and dynamically and dramatically change the language itself. So it's hard to draw the line between where Ruby on Rails starts and where the language ends. Okay, so from a domain-specific language perspective, Java doesn't do very well, and most of the limitations are in the syntax. And we do wind up doing metaprogramming-type things in Java, but we do it by bolting on additional syntax. Like, for example, to add ant tasks, well, we went to XML because we could delay binding and because we could dynamically configure them. With aspect-oriented programming, we added new syntax to really what amounts to an alternate language to express the point cuts. But the biggest substitute that you see out there is XML. And the reason is that we have excellent libraries to deal with XML, and XML has the characteristics that we're looking for in late binding and so forth. But we're starting to see other metaprogramming techniques push forward in Java. Annotations, I think, are a direct response to this type of capability in other languages. So you can build something that looks more and more like a domain-specific language in Java using annotations. That's why it's so important. Okay, let's shift gears a little bit to continuations in Seaside, and with any luck, this will be a little bit kinder to me. First, I'd like to talk about the concept of a continuation. If you were in the session yesterday, you learned that a continuation is like a save game. So you're about to walk into the monster control center. You've got 4 hit points left. You save the game, right? You walk in, get killed, restore game, walk in, get killed, restore game, and then you walk in, kill the monsters, and all is good. Well, the continuation is, for a while, was thought of as a simple academic exercise without much practical application. Let me show you what a continuation looks like in Ruby. I'm just going to start in a Ruby interpreter, so rather than have the background active record stuff in here. I'm going to define a method called loop. For I is equal to 1 to 10. So 1.10 is a first class range in Ruby. I'm going to put as I. So basically print the value of I. And then, this is a little bit strange to you probably. I'm going to call whatever's in this code block with the continuation. And that continuation is going to be passed to the code block. And all I'm going to do is return it. Okay? And now that's strange looking. What do you think it's going to do? What do you think this will do? Just count 1 to 5. Thanks a lot, Bruce. You've shown me a very cool but very academic and worthless version of a break. Right? But it's cooler than that. So let's say, let's actually grab the continuation object. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now what's this going to do? Guesses? 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Right? Now that's interesting, but again, it seems pretty academic. Until you think of the way that we build web applications today, then this little exercise represents a tremendous win. So you can look at the continuation as just a snapshot in a point in time, the call stack, the rest of the program, whatever conceptual model fits for you. Basically, you're freezing execution and you're saving that execution in an instance variable. Right? Now, what about web programming? It seems like we do a whole lot of that, right? So we take a number of different servlets, and for each servlet, it's got to be an isolated little program, doesn't it? Why? Well, because web development has to be stateless so that we can scale the web architectures. So each individual servlet is a standalone system, and we need to take these individual servlets and make up an application. Right? So the user can call the first one, call the second one, call the third one, and be good little users, or they can really mess us up, like go to the browser history, right? Or call up to the first one and press the back button. Now, there's a guy named Avi Bryant that had a bad experience with the back button. He was actually surfing on a major travel website. Was looking for a plane ticket. Said, okay, that's a pretty good price, but I think I can beat it. Left this window open. And everybody's saying, uh-oh, I already know the ending to this story, right? Went over here, surfed a little bit, found a whole lot of expensive tickets and said, nope, I can't do any better. Left this window, close this window. Came back over here and pressed order. And he bought that ticket. Now, it's bad to make some people mad. This guy is Avi Bryant, and he's actually brilliant. What he said is, what if we used continuations? So instead of saying, instead of having an application that's a lot of different servlets where the browser is fundamentally in control, why don't we look at this as one big, fat, stateful application, right? Now, wouldn't it be nice, instead of defending yourself across the browser invocations, where if you could think of things, if you could code one big stateful application and just have these little gaps where you call the framework and say, framework, automatically do something to protect me. And that automatic thing is snap a continuation, associate it with a variable, store that in the session, so now when the user comes back, or if the user presses the back button, I can literally come back to that point in time. Now, at the end of this particular workflow, if I save something to the database, now all I have to do is I have to handle the exception. I have to invalidate the past continuations. And that's it. So instead of having to code 5 different isolated servlets, like this, I can code one big, fat, stateful application like this. and then let the framework handle what happens in between. Right? Sounds pretty cool, but still a little bit theoretical. Let's bring it a little bit closer to home. Now, there's a dialect of small talk called squeak. This was actually invented at Disney, but it's absolutely impossible to tell. Right? Okay, so if you've ever worked with small talk before, you know that small talk works with an image. And with an image, you're basically working on a living, running application all the time. And when it's time to deliver that application, you extract the application from the image and then package it up and ship it. Well, this particular image, for those of you in the back of the room that can't see, don't worry, I'll read it to you. This says, WA for web application COM encoded, start on 9090. Well, 9090 sounds like a port, right? And then it has a URL. So basically, it's telling me that it has a running web server. So I brought up this image. There's a running web server. That's my starting point. So I'm going to copy this. I'm going to cut back over to my browser. Okay. Paste in the URL. And it gives me prompts me for a user ID and password. And here, this application is going to blow your doors off. This kind of looks like Tomcat for Smalltalk, right? But watch this. Yeah? You like that? Wait for it. Wait for it. Boom. So I'm going to hit plus a couple of times. Now, what's the value of the counter in memory? Well, it's 10, right? I'm going to press the back button a couple of times. And I'm going to press plus again. What's going to happen? Somebody looked at the back of the book, right? Boom. That's cool, right? The nice thing is that the application developer didn't have to do anything to support this. Well, how do I know? Well, we can go look at the code. Watch this. That's a small talk browser. And I'm working in a web browser, right? I'm going to see the method here called increase. See at the bottom there? That's increase is count, gets count, plus one. That's it. No special support for the back button or for browser history. But that's going to work flawlessly. Actually, I say it's going to work just like you'd expect. But it really doesn't, right? We programmers are used to thinking, hey, that's not the value of memory. So it's ironic that if you code applications with this, you literally have to teach your users that the web browser is going to work right now. Right? Think about the irony. Okay. So, but one of the nice things about continuations is, you know, I started here with this simple application. I can say, you know, take this counter, incremented a couple of times. Up way back at 3, at counter value equals 3, I saw a bug. So I'm going to toggle the halos, open this up, go over, and up, I see the bug. You know, not being from Texas, you wouldn't notice it, but a counter should count in big increments, right? Bigger. Yeah, that's good. Now that's a counter, right? So I'm going to set this. And when did I... why is it asking me for my initials? Source control, right? So this really is access to the Smalltalk browser from the web browser. Okay, so I'm going to back up to where I noticed the bug in the first place. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3. It's expired. I wasn't fast enough. So for demo purposes, I actually sped up the counter. Let's try that again, but quicker this time. So you could actually see the expiration. Well, now you've seen the expiration. But now, you know, being in Europe, you know, people are going to look at me funny if I count so high. So let's go ahead and fix that bug. Let's take this counter, look at the methods. The count method, the increase method, and let's take it back down to one. Commit this. And then go back button, and then say plus. And now the counter works like you'd expect. Now that's pretty interesting. And this works. So I basically went to a point in the past and applied a fix that I made after the thing that existed in the first place. How do I do that? Well, I had a continuation, which is the state of the program execution at the time that page was created. Right? Powerful concept. Now, I'm kind of playing up the back button support and the past history and the debuggability. That's not the primary benefit. The primary benefit of the continuation server is that when I code my application, it looks like this and not like disjointed servlets. I have one big, fat, stateful application. I lean on the framework to break it up into servlets. Right? So everybody that builds a massive framework has to build some kind of store with a shopping cart. You know, we had our pet store. The small town people were a little bit more jaded. They built a mail order sushi store, which to me is about the scariest thing I can imagine. Okay, so I'm going to take some of these. I'm going to add them to my cart. One, two. Now, the hard part of a catalog isn't the browsing of the catalog. It's the checkout. That's a wizard, right? So in this case, I say, yeah, I want to proceed with my checkout. Your name, street, main street, city. Do you want to use that? Yeah. I mean, no. Back button. Yeah. It all works, right? Expiration. Well, let's go ahead and do something that's going to break validation. Expiration is in the past. Let's say expiration is set that correctly and the fish is on the way. Now, we've seen that shopping cart implementation about a billion times. But let's see what the implementation looks like in Seaside. So I'm going to say, take this store, and there's a class there called Web Application Store Task, and there's a method on that that says go, or do all the work, right? Now here you're going to see an example of the code block that I showed you yesterday. So I say, isolate this work, call all this work in the context of a transaction. That's that little bit where it says we're trying to verify the contents of the cart. Then I go down and it says, go ahead and isolate this too, but this is what you need to pay attention to. Do you see the get shipping address? And then the use billing address, those sound like user interface pages. And I am reacting to the value returned by those user interface pages. Right? So this is basically the whole wizard. Get the shipping address. If the user says use the shipping address as the billing address, if it's true, go ahead to the next step. If not, go ahead and get the billing address. Just go ahead and ship the payment info to this particular address, and you're done. There's no special support for back button, for browser history. All that stuff is taken care of because now we have stateless performance because I release resources after each continuation call, but we have a stateful programming model, and that is a huge, huge win. Okay? Now, interestingly enough, Java doesn't have continuations, right? But Java is doing very, very well in this space. How many of you saw the Spring 2.0 talk. Pretty interesting stuff, right? Did Rod go into detail in Webflow? So Webflow uses an approach like this one, but instead of capturing a continuation, Webflow uses a state machine. So if you look at the tables in this room, it's one big state machine, and each one of those has a page, represents a page in this massive insurance company's form, and there are transitions between the nodes. Then you can easily imagine that, well, if I save this state and the instance variables associated with this state, then I can go back to that state and the transitions will work the same way. Right? So it acts like a continuation server without forcing you to implement continuations. So Spring Webflow uses something like a continuation. The downside is that you have to code that in, you have to code your flow, well, in a declarative language that expresses data well, which is XML. Now, if that's not attractive to you, well, you also have the opportunity to use something called the Rye framework. And the Rye framework also uses continuations, but Java doesn't have continuations, so Garrett had to write his own. Right? That continuation support has been ported to WebWork, which is the foundation of the action model in the next generation of struts. Now, isn't that ironic? To be cool and new and innovative, you're going to have to be using struts next year. Yeah. So there are a couple of other approaches. One is that I can take another language that's implemented on the JVM, and I can add continuation support to that language. Like, for example, Cocoon. Well, it's Cocoon is implemented, their flow is implemented with JavaScript. So you can implement continuations that way. And there are a whole bunch of betas out there that that are starting to do this thing. This model is really catching on. Now, the thing that could kill this model is Ajax. Because now you're not talking about the state of just a server. You're talking about the state of the server plus the client. Right? It's hard to synchronize all of that asynchronous communication. So there are a lot of people that are starting to work on continuation models that span the client and the server and restrict the things that you can do if you want that full continuation style of support. But the research is very early. Okay, I promised you a Rife example. Well, here's one. This is a guess a number game, and what I want you to notice is that this user interface is going to print a couple of different screens. But you see this line of code that says pause? That captures the continuation. Right? Big, simple, stateful, pure Java implementation. It would save you a whole lot of time. Webflow and Spring uses the state machine approach. This is also the approach that JBoss Seam uses, if I'm not mistaken, to give you the same type of support. So Java is really doing pretty well in this space. We're seeing an innovation that started somewhere else, really over 15 years ago with the Lisp language, and we're bringing those ideas to Java. Now, you've seen the advantages of the Java-based approach, and that's that I can express my Webflow in a language that's dear to me, and that's in the Java language rather than a language that's a little bit harder to palate for things like programming. But there are advantages of the state machine approach too. Now, if you look at the world as a state machine, now I can say the implementation underneath doesn't matter to me. So I can use Spring 2's Webflow with struts or Tapestry or anything else that Webflow supports. Right? I don't care what the underlying API is. I just have a layer of abstraction on top of my MVC. And I get just about all the benefits plus one. Now, if you think about persisting a continuation, it's not pretty, right? Because if you were to do some refactoring, that continuation would have some pretty strange and unpredictable behaviors. But if you think about persisting the name of a node in a state machine and the instance variables, that's not nearly so daunting. And we're starting to get something that acts like a business process. Right? Okay, so the state machine approach enables long duration transactions and continuations across them. Okay, let's shift gears and we'll talk very briefly about Erlang. I've got about 10 more minutes. That's about right. So we've got a problem in that the C-like languages, pretty much all of them, don't manage concurrency very well. And the problem is mutable state. It's a pretty basic problem, right? Every time that you assign a variable to something that's had a value before, that's mutable state. So Brian Goetz, Mr. Concurrency these days, has just completed a book called Java Concurrency in Practice. By the way, that's a must-have for your library. And he ends the first section of the book with the phrase, "It's the mutable state, stupid." Right? So we basically teach concurrency and distributed systems with functional algebras. So if you've ever been taken a graduate course in this area, and then you've come back and tried to apply the techniques with Java, it's very, very difficult. Because you're really trying to make the leap from, you're trying to express functional algebras in an imperative language. So in imperative language, you basically tell your program how to do something. Right? That's the way that your wife, your girlfriend, your husband works. You tell them how to do something. Now, functional programming says you tell the program what to do. That's how you wish your wife, your girlfriend, your husband worked. Right? So functional programming is a higher level of abstraction. Now, what's interesting to me is that concurrency models have been broken in Java, and there are a lot of bugs out there. Like, for example, I've got a collection. How do I protect that for concurrency? By synchronizing, right? I have two collections. How do I protect that? Well, you synchronize them both, right? Well, no, because if you're moving data from one collection to the other, you have to have an umbrella that encompasses both collections, right? That's a concurrency bug. Now, there are a whole lot of concurrency bugs in Java that are out there right now. We haven't had to pay yet. But there's a problem in that Moore's law that says we're going to double processing speed every couple of years is running up against physical limitations and how many transistors we can physically fit on a wafer. So what do? Well, you stack wafers, which means concurrency. Now, are we going to see Y2K style problems? I don't know if it's going to be that bad, but there's going to be a lot of broken glass out there. Right? So one approach to solving this problem would be to change the way the computers work around memory. One such model is called transactional memory, which basically, if you think about managing concurrency with large blocks of data, well, databases have had to do that for years. So if you start to treat a memory address just like a transaction in a database, that idea has shown a lot of promise from a research perspective. Still, most people say 5 to 10 years away. Now, another approach is you might say we need to get the programming language closer to the theory, at least the part that deals with concurrency. So there's a programming language called Erlang that was built from the ground up for concurrency, and it's starting to get some traction with soft real-time systems, soft real-time distributed systems, and typically very large systems, things like phone switches, manufacturing control. Okay? Now, we have moved closer to the theory in a number of places with incredible impact. If you think about databases, well, we started with networking and hierarchical databases where the structure of the database reflected the structure of the applications and the structure of the data structures. Now, relational structure was a lot more abstract. Everyone said that relational databases couldn't succeed because, well, there's too much overhead. Well, there was one big benefit that we didn't recognize at a very early point in time, and that's this. You could take a PhD student, teach him something called relational algebra, and you could say, go work on an optimizer dissertation with nothing but a pencil and a sheet of paper. Right? That's a tremendous advantage. So eventually, relational databases got so much faster that they swept away the hierarchical and the network databases. Now, you might say, well, what happens when the next database paradigm comes along? If it's not close enough to the theory, relational databases will sweep that away, too. I went to school to the University of Texas to work on an advanced degree. And my area of specialty was object-oriented databases. Right? Think about it. So IBM, Oracle, all the major database vendors were looking over their shoulders and wondering when the object-oriented databases were going to whip by the relational databases. Object-oriented databases matched the structure of our applications. But they were no match for the theory. And as the relational databases kept rolling forward and moving into new areas like heterogeneous databases, like optimizers that would work across CPUs, a lot of these enhancements could be done with pencil and paper. So you work on the pencil and paper, you work those ideas and techniques into real-life optimizers, and since the theory and the practice lined up, it was a very powerful combination. It's not the only place. Think of the way that we're building IDEs today. So instead of literally editing text, an IDE says, I'm going to show you text, but I'm going to edit the AST, the abstract syntax tree. And that enabled all kinds of refactorings that you couldn't do before and brought a whole generation of programmers, dragged them kicking and screaming from their Emacs editors and into IDEs. Right? So it's changed the way that we write IDEs. It's changed the way that we think about building accounting applications. The spreadsheet. Marvelous invention where you can write applications of surprising sophistication that run on a desktop. Think about simulating something that would be done in a spreadsheet with Java today. Okay. So what happens if you start to explore the idea that maybe you want to get close to the theory, but you don't know how? Well, Ericsson, which is a telecom from, is that Sweden? I think that's right. And they started experimenting. They started asking the question, well, why is distributed computing, why is concurrency so difficult? And they built up a language around these ideas. And they started studying other programming languages, and they started narrowing down to functional languages that worked at a higher level of abstraction without the theoretical baggage of the object-oriented system. When I say theoretical baggage, I mean that we rely heavily on state, that we rely heavily on mutable data, variable assignments, right? But if you could crank that abstraction up just a little bit, you could get tremendous results. So Erlang has built in concurrency from the ground up. If you read an Erlang program, you think, well, that's not coded very defensively. But that intuition would be wrong, because since a process is so lightweight in Erlang, you tend to fire processes to do just about everything. And when something breaks, you just let it die and start another one. And it's an amazingly robust and productive way to write software. It also has some features built in, like continuous operation, so it'll handle distributed deployments and things like that. Here's a little bit of Erlang syntax. I'm sorry it doesn't show up very well. But on the top, I've got something called a tuple, which is basically a list of a fixed length. And down here, I have something called a list, which is a variable length sentence. So to process things in Erlang, I don't tell the program, I don't tell my program how to do something, I tell it what to do. So to switch, if I have an array of numbers or a function of numbers in Erlang, and I want to switch 0 and 1, well, I'll say f of 0 is 1, f of 1 is 0, and everything else is x. Right? So you don't wind up doing things the way that you do in Java. Like iteration, I would do with recursion instead. So for a factorial, I would say the factorial of 0 is 1. The factorial of x is x times the factorial of x minus 1. Right? That looks a whole lot like the mathematical definition. Tell the computer what to do, not how to do it. I'm working at a higher level of abstraction. Now, Lisp or the functional languages have not gotten traction yet because not enough of us know how to do it. We don't know how to shape our head that way. But there's a lot of evidence that suggests that you get much more leverage and much more productivity out of functional systems. So to traverse a list, well, I'm going to use recursion. I say, well, the sum of a list, or the head, which is the first element, and the tail, which is everything else, is the head plus the sum of the tail, and the sum of an empty set of zero. And with things like these, I can build amazingly sophisticated data structures, traverse them very quickly with recursion. And the nice thing is that with functional languages, this is not an expensive way to do business, right? Because I optimize for tail recursion, which means that internally, this is expressed as iteration. Okay? And if I'm looking at coding for concurrency, I have concurrency constructs built in, like this PID is a process ID. Exclamation point means send a message to that process ID, and then you just express the message that you want to send as a tuple or a list. And by the way, there's string notation, which is shorthand for a tuple. To make decisions, I use something called pattern matching. So I say, well, receive, if I get a message that looks like head, then I process the message. If I get a tuple with one symbol called quit, then I process whatever done is. Right? Tell the computer what to do, not how to do it. So let's look at a quick Erlang demo. All I'm going to show you is that factorial in action, just so you can get a flavor for it. So Erlang has an environment. It's not a full interpreter. I'm actually going to compile my application. I have something that looked exactly like the factorial that you saw. So I'm going to compile that, and I'm going to execute that, which is factorial, which is the package, and then my function is called fact. So what's the factorial of 1? What's 1, right? What about 3? That's 6, right? What about 100? That would be bad, right? No? What about 1,000? That's a lot of numbers. What about, I can't even see the bottom anymore. What about 10,000? That's cool. Right? So you're seeing what you get when you can move up a level of abstraction. Right? Okay, I should probably stop now and spend the rest of the time in talking about what you want to talk about rather than blindly slogging through a conclusion. So let's go ahead and take questions. Well, while you're thinking, let me throw up a couple of challenges for you. Come on. Let's go back one. Okay. The first part of the challenge is to open your mind. There's a lot of cool stuff out there. Pick a programming language and try something non-trivial in it. It will change the way that you write Java. very much for the better. Right? The second challenge, second part of the challenge, is to change the way that you do things. Programming languages, maybe. Maybe doing a little bit of functional programming can get you away from so much of the mutable data, which gives you so much problem with concurrency. Maybe it means changing the way that you do your education. Like, we're starting to see that if you wrap education, which is just building your software skills, around other experiences, whether it's, a Outward Bound, which is a program in the United States where you go out in the mountains and work together as a team and do a ropes course or some climbing. Or whether you do, I'm working with Kirk Pepperdine on a education series on the island of Crete to do Ruby on Rails education, right? Not a bad way to go, right? You pay what you pay in the UK and you get to shift your environment, which changes the way your synapses are firing. It changes the way that you learn. It opens your mind to other experiences. And the last challenge is to start thinking about, now that we live in an age, we just saw a killer MQ or active MQ demonstration by James Dracken that said you can use virtually any client that you want to access real production, high power queuing on the back end. So what's binding us to Java for things where Java is not necessarily a good fit? Right? If you need to do two-phase commit, hardcore object relational mapping, Java is the place that you want to be. If you need to do high-level symbolic programming, maybe Java's not the right place to be. If you need to do simple database-backed web applications, it's kind of touch and go. Okay, so those are my three challenges. Questions? You're way too quiet and you're scaring me. Everybody wants to go home, I think. Okay, thank you. Yeah, but there are no XML pages behind that. There's a convention in Ruby on Rails that gets me in the right direction. We'll look at that in a second. So, and you might think that, hey, but if you assume things, aren't you going to really screw your users up? Aren't you going to make them design themselves into a corner? Well, the answer is no, because if you let your users override the chosen defaults, you really do get to have your cake and eat it too. Right? The configuration that does exist becomes a matter of only specifying exceptions. Again, Rife does this brilliantly. Maybe I should have called this talk 10 things that Java could steal from Ruby unless you're Garrett, well, and you've already stolen them, right? Okay. So let's look at a Ruby on Rails example to see how convention over configuration works. How many of you have actually coded a little Rails? How many of you have not seen any Rails at all? Okay, so most of you. Okay, so I have to go ahead and start the database engine because, again, I had a crash before the talk, so bear with me here. So, okay, now I have a database engine. I'm going to shift over here. I'm going to build an application, a Rails project called, Spain. Okay, this is basically going to create the default structure of my application. And this is going to start to enable my convention over configuration. Now Rails knows where to find the scripts, the application pieces, the tests. So this is the first small step. We need a consistent structure underneath everything. Okay, and we're going to create a model. What's Spanish? How about bullfight?
So I'm gonna create a model for one bullfight, right? And this is going to create the most important thing, the model here. So you see, create app models fight.ruby, but also some unit tests and stuff like that. We won't get into the testing aspect. But when you look at unit testing with when conventions are enforced, then the testing gets a whole lot easier because a whole lot of the default infrastructure for your testing can be built for you. Right? So I have, out of the box, I could say, run the unit test for this application. And they'll fail because, well, I don't have a database yet. Right? But I can run the default test right out of the box. Let's look at the model. Again, I'm opening my editor TextMate. I'm going to expand the font. Oh, well, I hadn't selected anything yet. I've got to select the model first. This is going to crack you up. So why bother to generate this thing? Yeah, thanks a lot. Now I have to go like customize this with code, right? Well, no. This is a fully working object model. Right? So I've got to create the database table. In fact, a default one has been created for me in what's called a migration. Let's fill some things out, though. So this said, give me a table called fights, and then give me a column called name. Well, let's say I need the name of the bull, right? And then I probably need the name of the matador, and never having been to a bullfight, I don't know what else I would need, but that'll give us a start. How do you spell matador? Is that right? Close enough? Okay. So this works now, and now I need to basically create a database. Again, I'm going to follow convention. I'm going to call this Spain Development. Spain was the name of my project. And I'm going to say rake migrate. And okay, so now I have a working persistent model. Now I'm going to say script generate the scaffolding for a model called fight and a controller called fights to manage all my controllers, right? So it creates this stuff. And what I have now is based on conventions, it knows enough to generate a default CRUD application, right? So I could start a web server. Let's go over here and do that. And I'm going to go over to a browser. And we're going to see that Rails is up. Yeah, that started. But more importantly, here's my application that we just wrote. Right? Give me a new fight, a bull name, the server side, matador is Bruce. No, maybe it's the other way around. Definitely the other way around. He's a witch, burn him. Okay, and then I can show this thing, edit him, or destroy him, right? Okay, and the thing that makes this possible is that we use conventions. So let's go back and look at that model again. You might say, what model? And you're just about right, right? There's basically precious little in here. What does this do? Well, it's going to go out and find the name of the class, which is called fight, right? It's a bullfight. And then I'm going to go out and look for a database table. Well, it's going to be a plural, so there's a pluralizer in Rails. So it'll say, go to the database table called fights, and then pick off all the attributes that are in there and add, for each column in the database, add an attribute to my model name. right? It knows that the ID is going to be called ID, right? And if you're thinking about it, well, yeah, I always name things that way, consistent across my column names. But instead of specifying things one time in the migration, I specify, well, the instance variable, the getter and the setter. I generated those with my IDE. The to and the from and the mapping and the database column. So I only have to specify it 6 times in my application. Right? A little convention can go a long way. Also, you saw the shortness of the controller method. Let's look at it again. So in Rails, controllers have to set up the instance variables, and then they get out of the way. Define a method called show. Well, that sets an instance variable called fight. It does an active record lookup. By the way, do you see the finder there? Well, the finder was automatically added. I could say find by bull or find by matador also. Those are created by default for me. But how does it know which view to render? Well, naming conventions. I'm going to invoke the view in, well, fights, show. See how that works? Convention over configuration. Okay, let's shift gears a little bit. One of the things that's going to be particularly heretical about this talk is I'm going to say that JSP is probably not the right way to build user interface code, right? Probably not too heretical anymore. We're starting to realize that. JSF, by the way, is making some of the same mistakes. One of the things that has happened is that we have learned to code in such a way that no code is ever in the JSP. Only it really is, right? It's just in there in the form of JSP tags or JSCL tags, right? What we really mean is only the view code gets into the JSP. Well, how do we get there in the first place? Well, the first problem is that JSP code is hard to refactor. When you have some Java code that creeps into the view, or creeps into, how do I get that into a JSTL tag? Well, it's hard, right? There's a 3 or 4 step process. How do I take that? What if I say, okay, well, you know, that was a good idea at the time, but now I think that code really belongs in the model. That's hard. Or I'd just like a helper to call. With Ruby, the code that you see in the JSP, which is an RHTML file. It's pure templating. With one exception, I can specify Ruby, or I can specify the results of a Ruby expression. And everything works with straight substitution. Right? Now, the problem is that JSP is so much more convenient than Java because on a JSP page, you make a change, you reload the browser. And that's the development experience that we're looking on. So the temptation is greater to do things the wrong way, to let model and controller code creep into the view. Okay, so I'm suggesting that maybe Java isn't the best scripting language, and maybe JSP is the wrong model. Well, the first thing that I think that we should do is look at the most productive, not the most successful, but the most productive development web development environments that are out there. You know, I think that there's a reason that Tapestry won the Duke Award at this year's Java 1. And part of it is because we're working with straight HTML. And we're working with a straight, clean templating strategy. Same thing for Rive, same thing for Wicket. A lot of the Java frameworks have this idea right. Wouldn't it be nice to have one standard one? Okay. The next little shift that I think that we need to make, it's not a big one. So I've already mentioned the fact that I really, really miss Hibernate, JDO, JPA, and Ruby. Right? I'm an object relational mapper expert by heart. I'm an evangelist for that style of technology. I think Ruby is really missing the boat, and I think that we're kind of steering away from enterprise projects that we can't attack because we're not embracing object relational mapping. The inverse is also true. Java is not investing in wrapping approaches. Right? The way that I see it, if you don't need a map, you don't need to be doing object relational mapping. Right? It sounds like a trivial thing to say, but it's really true. Think about how many times you've seen, let me pick on one framework, Hibernate. How many people have implemented Hibernate without understanding the database model underneath it? Right? If you pick an object relational mapper without understanding the database details behind you, you're in trouble. If you pick object relational mapping because, well, it's the easiest way to get there, you're probably right with Java, but the right answer needs to be there are better mapping frameworks when you need mapping, and there are better wrapping frameworks when you need to use a wrapping approach. Right? Okay, the next idea is that we need to focus a lot harder on simplicity. What happens with a new language is that we basically are going to work on the hardest problems all the time. And the reason is that in some ways the open source community cannibalizes the stuff that's out on the edge, right? So right now you don't see people making a whole lot of money on just servlet containers anymore. So you see the big vendors pushing full bore JEE containers. And that's starting to get commoditized too. And where are IBM and BEA going? Well, they're starting to push out a little bit more into the web services arena. And the ESBs, right? So you see this ever-expanding ripple of complexity, but you don't see the beginning ripples in the pond anymore. That's left to the open source community. So we really need to embrace the people who are working on simplified steps, right? When you think of what you've got to do, this is also my first thing that the community needs to focus on. Actually, I'll get there in a second. So when you think of what you have to learn to actually write a database-backed web app in Java, it's really an impressive stack, and we'll look at that in a second. Okay. More heresy. I'm going to start shifting to the community, and by community now, I'm partially leaning on the open source community, and I'm partially leaning on the Java community process. Right? The first thing that we need to do is to lose our fear of really deprecating something. How many deprecated methods are out there? And how many have we actually removed? Think about that. Has anybody seen this movie called The Princess Bride? And there was this Spaniard, and he was chasing the Sicilian, and the Sicilian kept saying, "Inconceivable! Inconceivable!" And he beats the giant. "Inconceivable!" He beats the swordsman. "Inconceivable!" And then finally turned around and looked at the guy and said, "I do not think that word means what you think it means." Like deprecation. Right? It's all about backward compatibility. But I think that Java has enough market share right now. Every 10 years or so, we should start to unmake some of the worst mistakes that we made, right? And start pulling those deprecated methods out. What's interesting is that Ruby's not a newer language. It's been around for 10 years too, but it's been in the limelight for a shorter amount of time. And that means, fundamentally, there's a whole lot less bloat in Ruby, right? But the new Ruby 2.0, so hey, great, we've got a break. We finally have a catalyst. We finally have users. So what do? We break backward compatibility. Good thing? I think it's a good thing. Not something that you do on a yearly basis. But every 5 or 10 years, Ruby's 10 years old now, you've got to go back and unmake those bad decisions. The problem is that Java's behind the leading-edge programming languages right now. And it's got to make some more radical changes to catch up. And the way that you make radical changes is not to add generics as syntactic sugar, right? The right call would have been to add generics all the way down through to the typing model. Right? If you need to add a compiler option to say, hey, I need to compile old style Java, then you do that. But you implement the features the way they need to be implemented instead of implementing some kludge based on some promise of backward compatibility. Okay, this comes to the last thing. I think that we really need to embrace beginners again. I talked a little bit about my interview with James Duncan Davidson. One of the words that he used more frequently than any other word in his interviews was approachability. He believes that Java succeeded because it embraced the C++ community and was approachable by them, right? I mean, you've got to solve a problem. You've got to scratch an itch. But you also have to be approachable. Think about what you have to teach a beginner to write a database-backed web application today. You say, well, okay, do the servlet thing. Well, to deploy a servlet, I need this XML thing. And XML just added that namespaces in the schema thing. Okay, so the first level. I need the Spring thing or this EJB thing to glue everything together because the articles say they always do. I need the I need a persistence engine. I'll use Hibernate, everybody else is. I need model view controller set up. I need something like, I think I need JSPs or something like it. Tell you what, I'll go and I'll learn these 60 binders. And then 4 months later, I'll come back and write Hello Persistent Web Enabled World. Right? That's an ugly, ugly scenario. That's one of the reasons that that it's so difficult for a consultant to train new developers. There's just so much work to do. My standard curriculum for a new Java developer, beginning Java developer for these technologies, is about 6 weeks. Compared to Ruby on Rails, I've got 1 and 2 week packages. Right, think about that. I can take a new Java programmer and make them productive on Ruby on Rails 3 times as fast as I can train them on the Java technologies. That's scary. Okay, so want to point out a couple of words that I didn't say or at least obsess over. I didn't make you do the dead like Elvis, not like COBOL thing. Did you guys read that post? How many read it? So funny story, I was actually doing the interview to promote a server-side Java conference, and the reporter, I was being really nice. I mean, you would have been proud of me. But the reporter says, Bruce Tate, right? Surely you think Java's dead. You wrote Beyond Java, right? I said, no, nothing could be further from the truth. What I mean is dead like COBOL, not dead like Elvis. Next day, wake up and the server side says, Bruce Tate says, Java, dead like COBOL, not like Elvis, right? So anyway, you didn't hear Elvis or COBOL until now. You didn't hear duck as in duck typing. I didn't obsess over the typing model. I didn't have to duck because nobody threw a tomato. And I didn't say that David Heinemeier Hansen word because that makes some people mad sometimes. I've got some resources for you, but let's get right to questions because I know you've got them. Comments, too. Everybody's in a stunned silence. I don't know. Questionnaire. Let's wait for a microphone in a second. Maybe you can whisper to me so I can prepare. We've got a question up here. We're going to wait on the microphone. Let me give you a challenge before we get to the questions. I think it's a great thing to learn a programming language every year. I didn't do it. I basically put my head in the sand for a long, long time. And I did the same thing with C++. I really suffered the consequences when it was time to ramp up on Java. I told myself I wouldn't do that again. Programming languages have a limited lifespan, right? And so you owe yourself to know the other stuff that's out there. And if you want to like Java, that's okay. Just know why you like Java more than X or Y or Z. So that's my challenge. Learn a programming language, do something non-trivial in that language, then make a judgment. Okay.
question, I read a lot of materials that development done on Ruby or on Rails framework around 10 times faster as compared to doing the same thing on Java.
Yes.
Is there any performance numbers, how the in terms of scalability and performance, how does it compare with Java?
So the, everybody heard the question. You hear that Ruby on Rails development is 10 times faster than Java development. That's basically a gross generalization. What happens is that you take general purpose Java frameworks and you apply them to a very specific problem where I was taking a very specific framework that could only do one thing well, but that thing happened to be, well, build default web-enabled database back applications, right? So I started from scaffolding, which was very close to what my customer needed. I added in the relationships. I used the domain-specific languages, and that worked well for me. So I think the analogy is a nail gun going to replace a hammer? No. Can you build frames 10 times faster with a nail gun? Absolutely. Right? It's a specific tool for a specific job, framing. Can't do everything a hammer can do, never will do everything a hammer will do. But I took a specific nail gun and applied it to a framing-like problem. So, good question, though. As far as numbers for scalability. So right now, I would say that the Ruby community doesn't have enough experience if you're building a Google, right? Most of us aren't building a Google. Probably the closest scalability numbers that you have are to Perl and to Python and languages like that, where the scalability is through shared nothing architectures. And if you think about the frameworks and the applications that have used such an architecture, some of them have gotten very, very large. Like Python, there's a lot of Python at Google that does some real lifting. There's a lot of Perl at other major .coms that have had hits in the millions an hour. So is there a flagship deployment like that for Ruby yet? Well, no. Basecamp's medium range, so that's starts to get you there, but that's not where I would apply it today. I would say if you need hardcore scalability, if you need two-phase commit, if you need object relational mapping with composite keys, these are the things that you should be doing in Java today, right? If you need to do nothing but build a greenfield database-backed web app, you owe it to yourself to at least look at the alternatives. Good question, though. And we had another one over here somewhere.
Yeah, how does JRuby fit into all this?
The JRuby question. So JRuby is a Ruby implementation. Instead of being written on C, it's written in Java. It runs on the Ruby virtual machine, right? Until a month and a half ago, it would not run Ruby on Rails. They still don't claim support for it, but I know that one of the founders of JRuby is working to push some production applications out with Ruby on Rails. They demoed this Rails application at Java 1, and it was five times as slow as base Ruby on Rails. And they said, oops, we forgot to switch it into production mode. And it was only half as slow as the implementation with no performance optimization, right? They're still running on Rails, the Rails servlets, which is RHTML, which is basically through FastCGI instead of servlets. So it's going to be within the range, the performance on JRuby is going to be within the range of the performance of native Ruby, which is definitely pretty good. But what can you do with JRuby? Well, right now, the support is a little bit limited. So one of the things that you can't do is you can't subclass a Java object in Ruby and then subclass that Ruby object back in Java, right? So it's essentially scripting for the JVM, but they're improving it at lightning pace right now. The framework basically was starting to stagnate, but now it's under new leadership, and people are using it for production things, and that's driving rapid improvement. Good question. Thanks.
Question in this direction?
Okay.
Is this working? Okay. In my experience with working with dynamic languages is that it's very difficult for larger teams to adopt them. What's your experience with the problems with large teams adopting dynamic languages where you don't have the as tight checks with compilers and things like that you do as you do with Java?
Okay, I personally think that's FUD, because I've seen large teams work on Smalltalk with the Visual Aid Smalltalk at IBM. But as far as what you can do with a large team in Ruby, I mean, I don't want to be, well, I guess I will be glib. You can do a whole lot in Ruby with smaller teams, right? You know, if you're staying in Ruby's sweet spot, which, you know, is, any kind of code generation because of text munging and regular expressions and ranges are good. If you're doing database-backed web apps, if you're doing something that requires symbolic programming, a lot of metaprogramming, then, think about all the multipliers that you can get. If you're five times faster out of the gate, and again, I'm not talking about five times across the whole community. I'm talking about five times for specific problems for which a language has been built. Then that's one multiplier. Then you don't need, if I've got a team of three or more, now I'm crossing with a Ruby team, I'm still under one management, one manager. If I'm on with a Java team, now I've crossed the threshold where I have to have multiple managers. Then you start to layer on communication costs, and then you're starting to say, hey, wait a minute, I can't do the pure agile approaches because I need more formal communication. So the multipliers stack up in a hurry, so that if you can find the right problem for a language or pick the right tool for a job, a lot of the problems that force you to implement with bigger teams go away. But I don't think anybody's building with very large teams in Ruby, though people are building very sophisticated applications by Java standards with Ruby. So, would I do the next space shuttle in Ruby? Probably not. Would I do 500 table applications with Ruby that with hardcore ORM? Probably not. Would I do a 50 to 70 page medium size project that I probably do with, 15 Java developers with three? I'm doing that right now, and I'm doing it twice as fast as the Java, the best Java schedule that they have bid. Yeah.
You talked about doing convention over XML configurations. I think it's great.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, there are a lot of applications out there which are not greenfield applications, so you are not starting from zero. What's the strategy there if you have an existing application you want to migrate to?
I think it's just a change in mindset. So right now, our mindset in Java is that we configure everything. I think that when you are starting to deal with the configuration, you say, what can we infer? Right? And I'm not picking on Java at all here. There's been a radically different mindset that's just happened over the past 6 months. As an industry in general, we thought the more tailorable, the more configurable, the better. We were looking for more configuration, not less. And then someone else thought that, hey, what can I infer? And it turns out that if you stay with standard programming conventions, or if you coerce your existing code base into those programming conventions, and by the way, Java has a huge advantage there, we'll call Eclipse or IDEA, then you can get a whole lot of leverage out of the convention over configuration. That technique is completely independent of programming language. It's just training yourself to ask the question, what can I infer? Right? And then acting on your knowledge. More questions? Got 4 more minutes. Anybody got a tomato? One right here.
I haven't looked at Ruby myself in any detail before now, but just from your presentation, I get a strong feeling of deja vu that a lot of the stuff you've shown us here could have been done in ML many, many years ago and work just as well, if not better.
So... So the Java community is not the only one that sent me hate mail, right? And beyond Java, I tried to put my understanding and label them as Bruce Tate's opinions, but I tried not to pull any punches. So one of the comments that I made was that the small talk train has rusted at the station, right? Never going to leave. The language is stagnated. It's still a pretty vibrant community, but it's a fixed size, right? And you could say the same thing about Lisp. So one of the frustrating things for Lisp programmers and Smalltalk programmers is they say, we've been here. And in fact, if you look at a programming language tree and the biggest influences in Ruby, well, they are Perl, Smalltalk, and Lisp. The difference this time is that we have a catalyst, right? I don't know what spring downloads are up to. I would guess about 500,000, maybe a little bit more. Ruby on Rails downloads by all the different delivery vehicles are up around 700,000 to 800,000 now. That's massive. We just went 1.0. So we have a catalyst, we have a dynamic language, and we have quick, but it's not quick and dirty anymore. I mean, we've had clean, quick and clean, but we've never had it with a popular framework. And I think that's what's different this time. And that's what has, you know, some of the Java visionaries so excited. And I don't count myself as one, but you know, like a Stu Holloway, like a Dave Thomas, like a James Duncan Davidson, like a Mike Clark, those guys are coding Ruby on Rails right now, and there's a big reason for that. Yep. Oh. Over here? Oh, got one back there.
Hello. Hello?
Okay.
One of my concerns with new languages coming out in this type of fashion is scaling for enterprise deployments. How does Ruby address security in terms of authentication and authorization and so on?
Okay. There's two separate questions right now. One I'm going to answer right now, how does Ruby deal with the enterprise right now? It doesn't, and you shouldn't. I mean, if you need the hardcore enterprise features, you're looking in the wrong place. If you need to build greenfield, web-enabled, database-backed applications, then Ruby's the place. The second question is, how does it deal with security? And the answer is by leaning on a lot of the infrastructure that's already in place. There are very good C APIs to a lot of the directory products, and there are Ruby wrappers for a lot of the LDAP like solutions. Now, I think that one of the dangers with Java and security, now Java has security baked into the JVM, right? Excellent thing. But you're not securing the JVM, right? You're securing the users and the applications on top of the JVM. And when they get to a certain level of complication and nobody understands them, well, if you can't understand it, you can't secure it. So that's a big problem. But if you look at like the Python language and the Ruby language, it's so dynamic that it's very difficult to secure at the JVM level, and that's just part of the nature of the beast. And we're going to have to learn to deal with security in different ways. And a lot of the techniques haven't even been invented yet. But I don't pretend to be a security expert. But you do have one right behind you.
There we go. I wanted to jump in real quick. Somebody asked a question earlier about ML. And for those who didn't know, and I know that this is not something that Bruce follows, which is why I feel compelled to jump in on this, there is a language that is gathering some momentum in the JVM space called Scala, which is basically an implementation, a later implementation of ML meets the Java language and the Java, the JVM. So if you're an old ML hack and you're really interested in doing ML on Java, look into Scala. It's a language being done by Martin Odersky.
Which is an excellent point. And I think that so one of the things that I'm very hopeful about is that for a while, Ted and I used to do this talk on J2E versus .NET. And at the time, the Sun position on new languages was that, well, Sun didn't support them because Java was the brand, right? And the brand was tied up with the language. But if we start thinking of Java as a platform, then we don't have to be talking about beyond anything, right? The Java platform, the virtual machine, can be around for many, many years to come that could far outlive any programming language. You know, if we don't, maybe Microsoft will. We're about out of time. Should we wrap up or should we take another question or two? Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.